This is not displaying right. Is there a way to
check the color on this? Is this always...
The color channels are not right, though. It's like yellowish,
right?
Oh, there we go. That's good. Okay, cool. Let's start out with something. Actually, can we keep the lights on this board here? Good morning. I'm Jonathan Pillow. You can call me Dr. Pillow or Jonathan or whatever you like. So let me tell you a little bit about my background. I was a mathematician. I studied math in college, and then I switched fields and I became a neuroscientist. So now I study the brain, but I use mathematical tools to do so. So I think part of what I'd like to tell you today is one of the things you can do with math. If you study math, I think a great thing about math is you can do almost anything with it. Almost any discipline needs people who have mathematical expertise to sort of point to new directions of research to help them solve existing problems in the field. And so the brain is one of those fields where we can learn an incredible amount from studying math. So I'm going to divide my talk into kind of two halves here. The first half, I'd like to tell you a little bit about the kinds of problems I work on. And there's not going to be too much math involved. It's mostly going to be kind of looking at some of the types of problems and hopefully giving you some intuition for how math can help us understand the brain. And the second half, I'm going to tell you a little bit about information theory, which is one of the mathematical theories. There are actually many mathematical theories we use to study the brain. But I'm going to tell you a little bit about, give you some intuition for some of the basic problems in information theory. All right, so the second half will involve some paper and pencil math. The first half will mostly involve looking at the board, looking at the screen, and hopefully this is a test of your visual system. If you can't see this flickering, then you're not awake yet. Okay, so before we do any actual content, I thought I'd start out with a fun little teaser problem that's completely unrelated to everything I'm going to say later. Okay, so it's Saturday morning, and the normal rules of math are suspended. And so I'm going to tell you that on Saturday mornings, 2 equals 1. So I'll show you a quick proof that 2 equals 1, and I'll let you all think about this in the back of your minds. Don't give the answer yet, if you can see... if you can see a problem with my proof, we'll come back after the break and you can tell me if you spot a problem. Okay, so this is involving just plain regular algebra. Can you all see the board if I write here? Okay, and the other thing is don't be shy about asking questions. So I've not given one of these before. If I say something that you guys are confused about or you want to ask me something, don't hesitate to raise your hand. Okay. Lights on the... Okay, good. All right, so this is a quick proof that 2 equals 1. This is very useful if you're... trying to convince your parents of something. Okay, so let's start with let A equal B. So these are just two numbers, right? A is going to equal to B, and I'm just going to do some basic algebra here. So first thing I'm going to do is let's multiply both sides by A. Right? We get A squared equals AB. Fair enough? Okay, now let's subtract B squared from both sides, right? This is allowed. A squared minus B squared equals AB minus B squared. Right? Okay, now we're going to factor this into two factors. I'm going to divide out a factor of A plus B times A minus B. Those of you who have had algebra, this is just FOIL, right? You agree that this is A squared minus B squared. If I write this on the left-hand side, I'm going to do the same thing on the right-hand side. If I factor out a factor of, I can factor out a factor of B, and I get A minus B here. Everyone happy with that? Good, I see nodding, that's great. Okay, now we're almost there. What I want to do is we have a factor of A minus B here and a factor of A minus B here. I'm going to cancel those. So this is A minus B, A minus B, and I'm left with A plus B equals B. Ah, we started out with A equals B, so I know that this A can be replaced by a B here, so I have B plus B equals B, 2B equals B, and I'm going to divide both sides by B, and I have 2 equals 1. Nice, huh? So you can wow your friends with this when you get back to school if you haven't seen this before. Think about it. The content of the talk will be completely unrelated to this, but this is maybe a fun warm-up problem, one of the problems from math that I remember playing with when I was a young mathematician. Okay, so let's... I wonder if I can get the color... Do you know what's causing the vibrations in this, is that... Because some of what I'm going to show is color images. That is unfortunate, but... Yeah, if you don't mind. Yeah, because it would be nice to have. Because some of what I'm going to say is in color. Okay. Okay. It was flickering in and out. It was showing white for a while, and then it looks like one of the color channels is missing. So it's got like.
I mean, after it was unplugged, it displays that ready screen.
Uh-huh. That was correct. Oh yeah, let's so actually. That means it's the monitor itself. How do we go to?
Yeah. Okay. So it's not a hardware problem.
It's not a hardware problem. You don't have another one of these connectors, do you? Oh, well. Well, we'll do our best without... Which... Background. Okay, so as I said, I'm a neuroscientist. I study how the brain works. And so the basic... Can we turn off these upper lights up here? Would at least help us get some contrast. There we go. Good. Okay. So... So I work with people who record signals in the brain in an attempt to figure out what it is that the brain is doing. Okay, so a typical experiment looks like this. We present an image to a person or an animal while we're recording what's going on in their brain. Okay, so usually we're recording from a single neuron or a group of neurons. And what we record out of those neurons is a series of times of spikes. So you may have heard of this before. The brain neurons in the brain communicate with spikes. They're little pulses of electricity. You can think of it that way. That are the currency of information transfer in the brain. So the theme of my talk is information theory, and we're going to talk about the way in which these symbols, these spike times, carry information about things that are going out in the real world. Okay. So a typical experiment looks like this: we present an image, we measure the neural response, we present another image, and we measure the spikes that were generated. All right, so we're looking to understand the relationship between images that come into your visual system, into your eyes, and the way that your brain re-represents those images in terms of spikes. Okay, so what we can think of is there's some function f of x, and I'll call that the encoding function that your brain uses to communicate and to extract information about the world. So the basic question my research asks is, how does the brain take stimuli? So how does it take an image of your friend's face, your dog, your house, your car, and it converts that into spikes? All right? The back of your eye actually converts this image into spikes and sends them to your brain. So the only information about the world your brain ever gets comes in the form of these spikes. And then how does the brain go about making sense of those, figuring out from one set of spikes that this is a house, from another set of spikes this is a face? All right, so how does the brain recode these images as spikes, and then how does it do mathematical operations on them? Okay, we can think about two directions to the coding problem. The encoding function would be the question of, how do I take a stimulus and remap it into, how do I code it with spikes? All right, that's the problem the back of your eye has to solve, your retina. I'll talk about that in just a second. And this allows us to figure out why the world looks the way it does. And I'm going to show you some visual illusions in a few moments to give you some intuition. The world, we don't just open our eyes and see the world exactly the way it is, all right? That's one of my goals is to convince you of that. What we see is actually the result of all the math. Our brain is doing certain calculations on the incoming light. And so the result of what we see is actually largely colored by those mathematical operations. And we know what some of those operations are, and I'll show you some examples of how they play out in a few moments. The flip side, of course, of encoding is decoding. The brain, of course, from this optic nerve here, only gets spikes. And your brain's goal is then to do the decoding problem. The brain has to figure out, well, I got these spikes coming in. What was out there in the world? Okay? All right. So you could think about this as mind reading. How do you... if we could understand what the neural code was, I could show you your friend's spike trains, or I could put them in a brain scanner and let you see an image of their brain activity, and you could figure out what they were thinking about. Right? That's pretty sci-fi. We're ways from being able to do that. But that's kind of the ultimate goal. I'll talk about motor prosthetics in a few slides. I'll define that for you. Okay, so high-level goals for today. I'm going to spend the first half talking about kind of a high-level introduction to computational neuroscience. Computational neuroscience is the name of the field that I study. So we study how the brain acts like a computer. Or you could subtitle this, Why Studying the Brain with Math is Cool. Okay, hopefully you'll be convinced after you see a few of my slides. And then the second half, we'll take a little break, and we'll come back and we'll do some actual coding and information theory, so you can get some hands-on feel for some of the problems that we like to study. Okay, so let me talk about a very simple model of a mathematical operation in your early visual system. Okay, so you may or may not know the tissue at the back of your eye that takes light, incoming light, and converts it into spike trains is a tissue called the retina. Okay, and the retina is basically a three-layered structure that has three different kinds of cells in it. There's an outer layer, which are the photoreceptors. These are the ones that detect light. So a photon comes in, hits your photoreceptor, and it changes that light into an electrical signal that passes to these bipolar cells. The bipolar cells then pass that information to a ganglion cell. And the ganglion cells are the ones that send spikes to the brain. So these are the output cells. These are the, you could think of the input as light coming in here. The output is this set of spikes that go to the brain. All right? So everything you know about the outside world came to you because of spikes that were transmitted down your optic nerve. All right, so people have studied this system for a while now, and we're starting to get a handle on what mathematical operations the retina does. So a very simple model of what these neurons do is they take a linear difference of the light that's coming in to a center bipolar cell and subtract off the light that came around on the sides. All right, so think of there's some light is hitting up here, and this light, these photoreceptors are stimulating this bipolar cell. That's adding to this input to this ganglion cell. Light over here or light over here will be subtracted from this ganglion cell. So the net output of this cell will reflect a difference between the light in the center and the light in the surrounds. Okay, so here's a pattern. Here's a stimulus with a lot of light in the center and not so much light on the sides there. Would you expect the cell to respond a lot or a little?
A lot.
A lot, right. A lot of spikes coming out now because you got a lot of light added with a plus sign, not so much light subtracted off. So think of this as 100, and this is, you know, 5 here. So 100 minus 5 minus 5 is 90. So you get an output of 90 here. What if I show a stimulus that's just a constant, like I'm staring at a blank wall? Or do I get a lot of spikes? Do I get more spikes or fewer spikes now? Fewer spikes, right? Because I'm subtracting, if I have 90 in the center and I subtract off 90 on each side, I end up with a negative number. I can't have negative spikes, but I'll have very few spikes in general. Okay, what if I now, pay attention now, because I'm going to show you an illusion that makes use of this in just a second. What if I change the stimulus so that now I have dark on this right-hand side? Compared to this response here, will I get more spikes or fewer spikes if I put a dark edge right on the left there? I reduce the amount of light. Let's say this. I reduce the amount of light on this side here. More. I'm hearing more. Yes. Good. This is being subtracted off. So if I subtract off, before this was 10. Now I made it only 5. I was subtracting off 10 before. Now I'm only subtracting off 5. So I have more. I'll get more spikes actually out of this image than I did before. Now that basic phenomenon that this cell, when it's sitting next to an edge with less light here and more light here. Explains a particular kind of visual illusion that's called Mach bands. Okay, if you look at this image, and I wonder if it's possible to get any darker in here. There we go. Okay, so the way you make this image, and I made this myself in PowerPoint, is you just, each one of these strips here is a constant luminance strip. Okay, so this is a dark gray, a lighter gray, a lighter gray. Each one of these has the same color from the left edge to the right edge. But if you look at it, you'll see, look at this one right here. It doesn't look like it has the same luminance all the way across, does it? You can see kind of a bright edge along this right-hand side and a dark edge right along here. Okay, so it doesn't look like this is the same gray level all the way from left to right. It actually looks like there's a gradient. It looks like there's a gradient of light to dark as I move across one of these stripes. Why is that? This is the first example of a proof where we don't just see the world as it is. If I were just to measure the actual light coming across, off of here and the light coming off of here, they're exactly the same. But the reason can be explained by the responses of these ganglion cells. So here's a cell sitting right here on the right edge of this image here. It's getting a lot of light into this plus here. It's getting less light to this negative sign on the side here. This is the picture that I was showing you just here. Picture one of these guys plunked down so that the plus is sitting right here, it's getting a lot of light. This negative is getting less light. I told you before, that's the cell that will respond more than one that's sitting in the center of this region here. Similarly, a cell that sits on the left edge here is getting more light. This edge is brighter. This bar is brighter here than this one. So it's getting more subtraction into this guy. This guy should be having fewer spikes output than this guy. All right. So as a result, the ganglion cells that are sitting on this right edge are actually spiking more. They're sending more spikes to your brain, and the ganglion cells that are sitting off on this edge here are sending fewer spikes. And so that's responsible, we believe, for the reason that your percept is that the reason you perceive this as being lighter over here and darker over here. Okay, I'll show you a few more examples of where this phenomenon comes in. Did we give up on fixing the monitor? That's too bad. Okay, can I do that? Yeah, it would be nice because there's color stuff coming up that would be much better.
So, I don't know exactly how to do this, unfortunately. The keyboard and mouse are located in the shelf.
Let me turn on the lights here. I'll ask you at the break. Okay, let's keep going. Sorry about the we took a break but didn't actually fix it. Okay, so. So this is an example that illustrates the same phenomenon. These are three disks here that have the same exact luminance. All right, so there's the same exact light hitting your eye off of this circle as there is hitting off this circle. But if you look at it, most people will report that this one looks a lot brighter than this one. All right, and the reason for that is that your eye is you're comparing this light surface to a dark surround. So those cells that I just told you about will emit a more vigorous response to this one, whereas here you're having bright. In the surround. So that cell that's subtracting off the light that's hitting its edges will give a less vigorous response here. Okay, this is maybe a kind of weak illusion. This one illustrates a stronger version of it, which is also will make you slightly crazy if you look at it. Yeah, so don't go crazy. Look away if you feel yourself going crazy. What do you see? So you see little, right, so if you look here, keep your eyes here, you'll notice that it's just a white circle inside, there's these gray alleyways and black city blocks here. But in the surround, where on the outsides of your eye, you'll see little weird black dots appearing in the middle. But if you move your eyes to look at them, they go away. All right, so I would say we don't actually have a complete understanding of how this illusion works, but we think it has to do with the fact that these cells I told you about have different sizes, the ones in the center of your gaze, near your fovea, than the ones out near the edges. And so they process the image a bit differently, depending on which part of the visual field you're using. But it creates this strange effect that something looks different when you actually look at it with the center of your gaze than when you're looking at it with your peripheral vision. All right? And so we're developing mathematical theories to explain, why does this happen? Of course, the world isn't changing when you move your eyes around. It's just that your visual system processes it differently, whether it's right at the center of your gaze than whether it's in the surround. Okay? So this is a strong example, I think, of the ways in which your brain is really actively building a representation of the outside world. You don't just passively see what there is out there in the world. You have to do some math in order to perceive what you actually do. Okay, so... So continuing on that theme, I want to show you that perception is not absolute. It depends on particular computational or mathematical mechanisms that are going on in your eye and subsequent processing in the brain. Okay, so here's another, I think, pretty cool example of that you will find hard to believe. Look at this image here, and what I want to tell you is that A and B, this square here labeled A, and this square labeled B, are exactly the same shade of gray. Right? Now, you don't believe me, right? It looks like this is a very light shade, and this is a dark shade here. Here's a comparison patch here, which, of course, doesn't look like either of these. I'm going to just blank out the rest of it. And you can see that I'll go back and forth between those. Nothing is changing. I made this second one myself by taking white strips and laying them down on top of that first image. There's no trickery going on here. So what's going on here? Can you think about why would, when you look at this image, why does this one look light to you and this one looks dark? What's going on here in this 3D scene? Yeah?
Because in the letter B square, it's surrounded by a bunch of dark squares, so we perceive the B square being lighter, as in the A square is surrounded by a bunch of light squares, so we perceive it as being darker.
Okay, so your answer is that it's related to how much light is hitting these surrounding squares. And that's exactly one of the things that's going on. It actually wasn't exactly what you're saying. These ones are lighter here, so it would look... You're saying it's a comparison effect to what's going around here. That's certainly one thing that's going on, but there's something else here. Yeah?
Maybe the brain is recognizing the pattern, and so it assumes that it's going to be the same color as the ones that happen.
Okay. Yeah, I like that. Brain recognizes the pattern. I would add one thing to that, which is that your brain is actually realizes the structure of this 3D scene, right? It's not just about the geometry here. Your brain realizes, hey, there's a big object here, which is casting a shadow onto the, right? There's a light source. You can clearly see the light source is out here. The light would be hitting this square A here with full light, right? It's not in shadow. This light is being obstructed here, and it's casting a shadow. All right. So if A and B were really the same color in the world, then I would have a lot more light bouncing off this one than I would this one. So in other words, this one should appear to me, it should have more photons hitting my eye from this patch than there are hitting my eye from this patch if they were really the same color in the world. So your brain is doing a calculation about how much light is hitting each surface. And so the fact that you're actually getting the same number of photons at your retina from this square A as you are from this square A, your brain says, well, there must have been a lot fewer photons hitting this patch A. So in other words, your brain is doing, it's not just reporting what light hit my eye. It's doing a complex calculation where it says how much light came in to that square, and then my percept will be influenced by the combination of how much light I thought hit it versus how much came off. So in other words, your brain is thinking that a small fraction of the light hitting this square was reflected, and a large fraction of the light hitting this square was reflected. And that's why your brain perceives these as different colors, even though they're not. Okay? So this is just at this high level to show you that your percepts are really constructed by these mathematical operations. And we have ways of modeling how your brain does this inference. How does your brain... Your brain is all the time when you look at the world, it's doing calculations about geometry, about the amount of light hitting different regions. I'll show you another example here. So this one is an even stronger effect. Let's see if it actually works here. Good, okay. What I will tell you is that... Let me remind myself of which two it is. This... Blue. So what I'm showing you is it looks like the same cube here on the left and on the right. What I will tell you, this is a very nice example from Bolotto. This blue square here, it has a yellow filter in front of it, is actually the same exact light hitting your eyes, the same exact shade on the monitor as this yellow square here under a blue light. And moreover, neither one has any color at all. Both of these are gray. All right? So this is not yellow, this is actually gray. This is not blue, it's actually gray. Okay, I'll show you that I made a mask that will come up over it, right? Watch this mask come over. You can see that this is actually just the same shade of gray sitting here as this one here. All right, so why does it look that way? Well, your brain is doing, I would argue, your brain is doing a calculation here. And here it's like your brain, you look at this side and you think, well, I have blue sunglasses on, so I'll discount the amount of blue I see in order to infer that, well, that must be yellow underlying this blue filter. Here you see that everything is shaded yellow, so I can discount the amount of yellow I'm seeing, and when I discount this gray from amount of yellow, I get blue on the other side. I actually made a second example that'll show you this even more, hopefully, convincingly. So this gray over here, let me drag this into your field of view here. Oops. Sorry, this is novice hour. Okay. All right, sorry. Okay. Here, I'll show. So I made this is a gray bar that I made here. And I'll show you that if I drag this gray bar into the middle here, right? Right, this is just a gray bar. I'm going to drag this up so it touches that blue square on the left and this yellow square on the right. You can see they're exactly the same color. Right? This gray bar here looks like it's changing from bluish over here to yellowish over here, right? That's just a gray bar. So your visual system, like this young gentleman over here said, your visual system is doing a comparison between what it sees in the middle and the light that's hitting you in the surround. And it's that comparison is telling you that, well, the bar is changing color as I move across here. But it's actually not. This is actually just your brain doing calculations to discount the amount of light that it sees. Okay? Do you guys get that? All right. Hopefully you're convinced. I didn't see any head nodding, but... Okay, so let's go back to it. I'll show you one more example of... Now, and I want to do an experiment for you. I want you to look at this image here and keep... I'm going to show you another way in which your brain does certain mathematical operations on the incoming light to construct a percept. So stare at the at this little black circle. You can do it on the left one or the right one. Stare at this little black circle here. We're going to stare at it for about 15, 20 seconds. Okay. What's happening while you stare at this circle is that your brain is adjusting the neurons in your retina are adjusting their response properties. They're getting fatigued by what they're being exposed to, and they're systematically adapting their response properties so that they're going to change the way they react to light. Okay, keep your eyes fixed there, and I'm going to flip to a new image. Okay, this is a black and white image. Take a second for you to realize that. Move your eyes around. There's no color in this image. Okay? But what happened is we by exposing you to this image for a long time, just do it again, we should be able to top it up again. By exposing your eyes to this image for a while, right, this region is blue. The after effect should look yellowish. This outer region, this orange over here, the after effect should look blue. When I flip forward now, you should see blue sky and yellow castle. Okay? So we have a mathematical theory of how this happens, and so we can predict, right, we can predict the way the world will look to you based on the kind of math that we use. So in other words, neurons adjust their response properties after prolonged exposure to an image. We can compute what these changes are like. Specifically, we know what kinds of after images we get. Red gives you green after images. Blue gives you yellow after images in general. Black gives you white after images. And I'll show you another example that that illustrates this very nicely. Okay, this one is... Oops. Can I not move this? Okay, so take a look at this guy here. What I want you to do is keep your eyes in the center, X. Okay, what you see is a ring of circles, and one at a time those red circles are disappearing. Okay, so there's no actual, there's only one color. There's a gray background, and there's a ring of red circles that are one at a time disappearing. And what you should see is if you keep your eyes fixed on the center X here, keep your eyes here, you start to see a green circle that's moving around. This is the same adaptation phenomenon we saw in the last one. You're staring at red for a long time. Then when the red disappears, you're seeing the after image, which the red image, a red exposure creates a green after image. So you're briefly seeing that green after image, and you'll see actually something else that's even crazier. If you keep your eyes really stationary in the center X here, you should actually get to see it where the red circles will disappear entirely, and you'll just see green chasing it around. You'll see a green circle moving around by itself. Do you guys get that? Okay, we don't fully understand how that happens. Basically, what we think is that your brain starts to discount things. If they stay stationary for too long on your retina, your brain starts to think, well, maybe this isn't relevant. I shouldn't pay attention to this anymore. And there are theories of attention that tell people how that happened. Anyway, that's I don't know, one of the cooler examples, I think, of color adaptation. Okay, let's go back to this. Okay. Okay, we'll move on from color for a second. Here's an image of some bumps, okay? And so I want you to look at these bumps for a second, and I want you to tell me, for this center bump, do you see this as bowed outward toward you or bowed inward? Okay. How many people see this one as coming out? How many people see it as bumped inwards? Okay. Basically, everyone sees it as in. Why? I'll tell you. All of these circles are the same mathematical object. It's a gradient of light from top to bottom on these side ones here. It's light moving smoothly to dark. This center one is just reversed. It's moving from light to dark at this other edge. Why is it that you think, could anyone come up with a theory for why does this one look, almost everyone will report that this one looks like a divot on a golf ball, right? It's bowed inwards, whereas these ones look like they're bumped outward. But yet mathematically they could be either one. Why do you think we see it as bumped inward?
Does it have to do with the sun?
Great. So there are two alternative interpretations to this image. One would be that the light source is above. The sun, if this is illuminated by the sun, right, the sun is up high, so the light is coming from above. If the light is coming from above, it's going to hit, if this guy is bowed outward, right, it'll hit the top of these bumps here. But if this guy would be cratered inward, it would hit the bottom lip of this divot here, and you'd have shadow at the top. However, if I showed you, I could actually make this perceptually reverse for you. If I showed you a light source, if I could convince you that the light was coming from below, so try to imagine this for just a second. Think about if light were coming from below here, well then you would perceive this guy as being a bump outwards. And these guys would be divots inwards because the light would be hitting this upper lip here. Why do you think though, so in other words, this is equally, you could perceive this as these bumps outwards with a light source from above, or these guys as bumps inwards with a light source from below. Why do you think we mostly see it, why do we mostly perceive it the first way? Yes?
Is it because the sun would
have to go around? Well, yeah, I think you said what I was looking for, which is that the sun, I mean, the lights, how often are you in a situation where what you're looking at is above the sun, or the light source is below? It might be at night you would be driving by and there'd be something with, you know, floodlights lighting this up from below, but that's very rare. Mostly we walk around in the world, the light is always coming from above. So even though this image is ambiguous, you could perceive it as one of two different ways. What you've seen before in the world is mostly things with light sources coming from above, and so when you looked at this, you just naively assumed, well, the light must be coming from above. Okay, this is an example of something called Bayesian inference, and I'm not going to talk too much about this. The basic idea is that what you see when you open your eyes isn't just about the light that's coming into your eye, it's also about the prior beliefs that you've built up. Okay? All right, so in other words, you walked around the world for a long time, and you happen to live in a planet where the sun is up in the sky. If you lived on a planet where the only light source was, say, the Earth itself emitted light, it was a phosphorescent Earth, and all the light came up from below, you would probably look at this and perceive it differently. So you've been exposed to certain regular conditions of the world. These are formalized by something called prior beliefs. And people in perceptual psychology and mathematical psychology use Bayes' rule to model this. Roughly what we're interested in, I should say, this is Bayes' rule for those of you who haven't seen it. It's just a formula for manipulating conditional probabilities. But the particular probabilities we're interested in here are depicted right here. We're interested in knowing what's out in the world, what's the probability of what's going on in the world. In other words, is that bump outwards or inwards as a function of the light on our retinas? Bayes' rule tells us that this is proportional to the probability that we would get that sensory input, given what the world is like, times a prior, okay? And what I want you to believe about that, this previous image here, either world state, the bump inward or the bump outward, could have generated the same sensory input. So this term won't change at all. What's different is you're more likely to be in a world where the light source is above, given what you've seen so far. So your prior influence, your percept would be this left-hand side of the equation here, and your prior beliefs will play a strong role in convincing you of that. I'll show you a couple other examples that illustrate this, I think, a bit more convincingly. This is an example of an illusion called an Ames room. All right? Does anyone have any idea what's going on here? Is this, well, what, let's see, what, first of all, what do you see when you look at this? Yes?
Well, I see a very small man, then a somewhat tall man, and a very tall man that is bending his head over because he can't fit in the house.
That's right. That's what almost everyone sees. You look at this and you think giant guy, intermediate guy, small guy. That's actually not what this is. This is a picture of a very specially designed room. The picture is being taken here. It's actually a room that is trapezoidal in shape here. So these guys, this guy, and this guy are actually the same size. It just so happens that this guy is much further away. This guy is sitting way far away from you, so he's gotten, you know, the space he takes up on your retina is smaller. This guy's closer, so he looks bigger. And of course, the roof is slanting down as well. So the roof is high up here, the roof is low. So, I should say, both interpretations are possible. A interpretation is that you're looking at a trapezoidal room with three guys that are the same size. Interpretation B is you're looking at a square room, and I should say this is showing you why this guy of this size, if you thought he was only this far away, he looks small, right? This little circle, to take up the same amount of space on your retina, would have to be small, intermediate, and large, even though this guy is the same size as this guy, is the same size as this guy. So worldview B is also possible to have generated this image, right? I could have either taken a photograph of scene B or of scene A. They would both produce this same exact image. Why is it that when you looked at this, you all went for B? You all thought that it was a square room with three guys of different size. Why is that? Yes? That's right, but I mean, in both scenes, their feet are against the wall, right? Here, his feet are against this wall, and that's in A, right? This guy is against this wall. This guy is against this wall. In scene B, they're also against the wall. So why is it? What I'm telling you is that image could have been generated by either world state A, where you're looking at a trapezoidal room, or world state B, Where you're looking at a square room, yes.
Because most rooms we have are square and they're
perfect.
Not
most rooms you've seen before are square. So in other words, your prior beliefs, what you've been looking at so far in your life, you've never seen a trapezoidal room. So you just look at this image and you know, well, this could have been generated by any, you know, there's actually infinitely many different rooms. I could take this room and I could smear it out. You know, any trapezoidal room that produced this same image here is possible. And it would just change the size of the guys. Why is it I perceive a square room? It's because of our prior beliefs. This is the argument of the Bayesian theory of perception, is that our brain goes with the one that's more likely under the prior. You've seen lots of square rooms. You've never seen a trapezoidal room. Therefore, when you're presented with an ambiguous scene that could be either one, you'll go with what you've seen before. Question?
So we're used to seeing people of different heights.
We are used to seeing people of different heights. That's right. Great. Yeah, so this is maybe a little bit larger variability in height than we normally encounter, but still, it's not impossible that you would see a guy this much smaller than this guy. Yeah. So we have seen lots of cases where people are different heights, which would be different heights here, and square rooms. We've not seen so many cases of same size people in weirdly trapezoidal rooms. Okay. I'll show you this one. I hope blow your mind. This is the final example of Bayesian perception. This is a movie of. Does it work?
This is Apollo's head. Actually, at the moment, it's a perfectly normal head of Charlie Chaplin. But wait, as it comes round...
This is a video. Actually, let me pause it for a second.
...will you, that it's hollow. The back of it coming round now...
Actually, we don't need the audio. Okay, what this is a video. This is not a trick. Someone took a mask, right? A mask, it's painted on one side, and the back of the mask, the inside of the mask, is just clay-colored or whatever. And they just set up a light source, and they videotaped it as they spun the mask in a circle. All right. So what you're seeing, the whole time this mask is rotating in the same direction. But what I think you guys, I heard the oohs and ahs, you're know that even right now, this mask is still turning to the left. It's turning that way. But what do you see?
His face is turning.
You perceive, so in other words, this is like the dimple one, right? The dimple one, that was not so strong. Here, even though the face is really inward, you're perceiving the face as pumped outwards towards you. And in that world, you can only it's a face coming out towards you, and it's rotating to the left. Okay, so we'll watch one more time. Try if you can. See if you can hold on to the belief. This is really moving to the left. Okay. So I think this shows you how strong your prior beliefs are. So what we have here is the same thing. There are two possible interpretations. Given this video that you watched, that face could either be convex, in other words, coming out at you, or it could be concave, bowed inwards. The video could have been produced by a convex or a concave face, but so these two terms are equally likely, but how many concave faces have you seen in your life? How many times do you look at someone and their face is actually punched inwards? Never. Hopefully never. Yeah. All right, so the argument would be that it's a very strong prior for outward faces, and because this prior is larger, you can't help but perceive this. Because this prior here is so strong, your beliefs, this term on the left here, you believe that it's a convex face given the images on your eye, even though you know cognitively that it's really an inward face. Okay, this is often called the hollow mask illusion. Very strong example. Okay, so last type of example I'll talk about. So what I've said so far is about sensory perception. We know that you don't just perceive the world as it is. Light comes into your eye, and your brain starts doing some computations. Your brain re-encodes that incoming image in terms of spikes, and then it does some mathematical operations to make sense of it. Most of the time, that works out pretty well, right? You don't have trouble figuring out whether you're looking at your friend's face or a bicycle, right? You don't make those kinds of mistakes. But you do make mistakes. We can design particular illusions that show you what mechanisms your brain is doing and particular ways in which these mathematical operations fail. We can design special scenarios. Those are what we colloquially think of as illusions. I'll show you another kind of example, which is more evidence for our understanding of the mathematical operation of the brain, is that we can design computer chips that will do the same processing that's normally carried out by neurons in your brain. Okay, so I'll show you two examples of these. The first kind so basically the idea that a neuroprosthesis is to replace neurons in the brain with silicon chips, which do the same mathematical operations. So far, we don't know enough to do this you know, very deep in the brain, but we can do it both at the input, the sensory input layer, and we can do it at the very edge, the motor output layer. We're still a ways away from being able to simulate a whole brain or understand what's happening sort of deep in the middle of the brain. So one example of a cochlear implant, one example of a prosthesis that I'll tell you about is the cochlear implant. Okay, so in people with normal hearing, what happens is sound waves come into the ear, they vibrate the eardrum back here. The eardrum vibrates these bones, which causes fluid in the cochlea here to move back and forth. This fluid sloshes back and forth, and then you have hair cells that will bend in the fluid, and then when they bend, every time they bend, they emit some spikes. Okay? That's a very crude description of what happens in normal hearing. Some people, their hair cells, those hair cells that are supposed to move with the fluid, will die, and so they're completely deaf. All right? But if their hair cells die, sound waves will come in, the fluid will move, but no hair cells will vibrate, and so there will be no spikes sent to the brain. That person will not hear at all. However, they have completely intact neurons that would carry those signals to the brain. If we could find some way to get spikes into this nerve here, we could restore hearing. And so that's the idea of the cochlear implant. Cochlear implant is a prosthesis. The person wears a microphone here on their ear. There's a computer chip here that does some processing. What kind of processing it does, I'll tell you, it's called a Fourier transform. It takes that incoming sound wave and breaks it down by frequency, which is the same thing the cochlea does when it's working normally. So it then transmits these signals across the skin, so it's a magnetic connection that sends signals through the skin, and then this receiver here then will directly stimulate the neurons along the cochlea that send those signals to the brain. Okay, so effectively we've taken these hair cells are the first kind of neurons that would have been there to start sending these signals to the brain. We've replaced them with the computer chip effectively. And I should say these things are really pretty impressive. My roommate in college had one of these, and he of course it helped him to also be able to read lips, but he could he could function very normally. In fact, one thing that I always thought was cool is he could plug his headset directly into the phone. So, you know, normally, right, the phone has an electrical signal that comes in. It generates pressure waves in the air, which travel into your ear, which then get sent back into electrical signals. Well, for him, the sound never traveled through the air at all. It was electrical signals in the phone. The electrical signals in the phone went right into his transmitter here, and they went across here in the form of magnetic waves all the way into the brain here. So, you know, there was never any sound coming out. You couldn't ever eavesdrop on his conversations. The other great thing is he could take them off at night and, you know, sleep through any party that you wanted to have. So he was great as a roommate because, you know, haven't you ever wished you could just turn off your ears, when you're having a distracting noise? This is effectively what this allowed him to do because he could make sure that there was, you know, by removing this transmitter here, no sound was getting in anymore at all. Right. So there's some advantages, and of course we're a ways away from being able to design these effectively enough to replace normal level of hearing. But they're getting better all the time. Mainly because we have better understanding of what kind of signals we need to send the brain in order for it to understand the sound that's coming in. Did I see a question? Was there a hand raised? Yes.
What would happen if you had normal hearing?
It's a great question. So you're getting into a very hot topic, which is sort of sensory augmentation. You know, could we, you know, we could restore hearing to someone who doesn't have it. Could we give you, you know, a microphone that'll detect frequencies that are so high only your dog can hear them, or so low only an elephant could hear them, and then you could, you know, transform them into your brain in some other way. So this is a way you could think about giving yourself new sensory powers that we don't have. So I don't think you would need this if you had normal hearing, right? If you already have regular sound waves coming through, you wouldn't also need to transmit them via this extra electrode here. But I mean, you can use similar techniques for getting information into the brain that wouldn't get in there otherwise. So you could think about giving yourself X-ray vision, literally, right? You could make a detector for X-rays, and then take those X-rays, transmit them into neural signals, and then stimulate the optic nerve so that you were getting spikes to your brain every time an X-ray hit your detector. Right? So that is really something you could do. Yes?
So if you hear like loud sounds, then it can damage your hearing. For this person, would a loud sound still damage their hearing if they don't have the hearing?
So it wouldn't damage his hearing because so the damage is often due to the fact that if you have too much sound coming through, the pressure wave is too strong and it can damage those hair cells. Well, his hair cells were already gone. What I don't know is whether Yeah, what I don't know is whether if you made the sound too loud, would he perceive it as painful? So in other words, I think that was all done in the processing unit here. So the microphone would saturate at a certain level, and you could keep making the sound louder, but no more spikes would come through. So I think that handled that problem just fine, so that it would automatically cut out at a certain sound level, and it wouldn't keep going up. But it's a great point that we have to be careful with. Those hair cells are fragile, and actually you lose them as you, the older you get, you lose the ability to hear very high frequencies. And the more you go to loud rock shows, the quicker those hair cells will die. So that is the key. The key element is those hair cells. Yes?
So this cochlear implant, is the reverse effect of it is what you see in noise-canceling
headphones? Noise-canceling headphones, let's see. I mean, the noise-canceling headphones are, I believe, they're recording the background noise. So you're trying to play some music through your headphones. In a sense, it is the opposite. They're recording the incoming background noise, and then they're adding a canceling pressure wave such that you don't hear that anymore. That's true. Yeah. So this would give you a very powerful form of noise canceling headphones. You could go right into the brain and cancel out the noise. So don't cancel it out outside in the world, but cancel it out in your brain. This is the kind of it sounds like sci-fi, but these are the kinds of things that you could in theory do. Question?
He would hear his sound differently than a normal person does because it's coming through that transmitter and receiver, right? As opposed to a person because it's going straight through your skull, right?
So there are many reasons that he would hear differently. One is, you're right, he's hearing a microphone that's located here on the outside of his ear. Normally for us, the sound would be echoing off these different folds of the ear coming through here. It would also be transmitted through the bones. Another main reason is I think the early versions have 24 electrical contacts here, whereas you have hundreds of thousands So in other words, the resolution and frequency is much lower. I should say, it's not like you have a surgery to install this and then you hear the next day. It takes a while for your brain to retrain itself to interpret the signals coming through. It's better when they can do these surgeries early when someone's still a child. Their brain is still more flexible and can adapt. If you get this in adulthood, it's much harder for your brain. Your brain is used to interpreting the sounds that come out of the normal cochlea, and it's much harder for it to relearn the mapping. So we're a long ways away from being able to sort of replicate the exact same pattern that the cochlea would give in normal hearing. But you pointed out another one, which is that the way the sound is picked up here will influence what they hear. So I should say he was actually really good at one-on-one conversations, but he was not so good in a crowded room where a lot of the other noises are coming in. There's echoes coming off different sources. Our brain is very good at canceling those out. It's sort of only paying attention to the sound we want to hear. It's much harder with current technology, but it's one of the problems people are trying to solve. Yes?
So would someone with one of those implants lose positional perception?
That would depend. So the positional sense, right? Your sense of balance is controlled by a different part of the inner ear. So these are called the semicircular canals. They also have fluid such that when you rotate your head or you lose your balance, there are hair cells in here in the semicircular canals that will detect that. So I don't actually know. His balance was fine. So I think it was only the cochlea, the part that's responsible for processing sound, that was affected. Let's move on because I do want to get to the second half here. Let me show you one more example of a prosthesis. The first one was a sensory prosthesis. This is a motor prosthesis. So this is a kind of device that's designed to help people who are paralyzed because their spinal cord has been transected. So their brain is still working just fine, but their brain can no longer send signals to their muscles. This is a video taken in Andy Schwartz's lab at the University of Pittsburgh. And what he's done is they have a recording device that's recording neural signals in the motor cortex of this monkey. And they're reading out those neural signals, which would normally drive the animal's arm. You can see his actual arm is inside this little tube here that keeps him from moving it. And it's actually being used to drive this robotic arm here. So this is just a robot. He's actually controlling a robot with his thoughts. And the task here is the experimenter is putting little marshmallows and they're positioning them at different places. And he has to use his neurons in his brain that would normally tell his arm to go out and reach for the marshmallow. He's telling it, he's using those same neurons to control the robotic arm. Okay? So this kind of research is still in its infancy, but they've actually started doing experiments in humans, humans who've lost the use of their arms. What do you have to know in order to be able to do this? Well, you have to understand the neural code. You have to understand what these spikes mean. I have to see that if I see 25 spikes, that means move the arm further to the right. If I see 10 spikes, that means move the arm further to the left. That's a gross simplification of what the actual code is. But we have to learn how to read neural activity in the brain. Normally, the neural activity in your brain is transmitted and will cause your arm to do whatever you want it to do. We have to learn that code in order to figure out how to drive this robotic arm. Yes?
So, like, when a person has a prosthetic leg or something, it's like they're moving their regular leg.
Prosthetic legs that exist are merely physical supports that would allow you to... that we don't have neural prosthetic legs yet. So the idea here is it's actually electric... There are motors... Right, the ideal would be you make a robotic leg that has motors, has muscles in it, that you could control with your brain. The current, you know, the Oscar Piscatorius, the runner with the carbon fiber blades, there are no moving parts in those. They're just springs, basically. So so a ways away from being able to actually design these that you could let people wear them and replace their normal arms and legs. But you know, that would be the goal, at least, would be to say, you know, normally when you move your leg, there's a part of the brain that's responding in a way that controls that movement. We'd like to be able to read those neurons and transmit them into different motors that would cause the robotic leg to move. But we're a ways away from that still. Yes?
Would the arm transmit signals back to the body? Like, so if someone's
trying to stop the arm, would you feel that? Great question. So far, no. But so in other words, this is a one-way readout. Read out what's going on in the brain and tell the robot to do it. If someone else knocks the robot arm to the side, the animal will only know that by watching the arm with his eyes and seeing that it didn't go where he meant it to go. When we move our arms, we're getting feedback from the arm itself. We have touch sensors, and we have sensors in the muscle themselves that would say, oh, I was trying to move this way, but I encountered a force. And so I have to now send new signals. So this gets into the issue of control theory. So it's an active process. You need to sense where your arm is and then issue a correction in real time. So that's all in the future, would be to give this robotic arm some sensors of its own that could be transmitted back to the brain. So you're right. The ideal thing would be sensory and motor prosthetics so that you had both sensory signals coming into the brain about the position of the arm, maybe what tension the muscles were under, if something was touching it on different sides. That would be the sensory side. The motor side then would tell it what to do in response to those sensory signals. There's many, many problems to solve here, and that's a very important one. Let's go ahead and... let me just wrap up, and then we'll take a little break here. The high-level idea that I want to tell you about is this idea that interchangeability. That if we understand the mathematical operations that are being carried out in different parts of the brain, and indeed the brain if the brain really is a computer, then we can replace different parts of that computer with different computers. In other words, we can replace the neurons that normally carry out some mathematical operation with silicon, with a digital computer that would do those same operations. So you can think normally you have sensory input coming in and your brain would process them in order to generate motor output. If certain parts of the brain are not working, though, we could replace them with a computer chip that does the same computation. The key, of course, is we have to know what those computations are. We have to know what mathematical operations are necessary to take sensory inputs and convert them to motor outputs. And moreover, we have to know how different parts of the brain communicate with each other. So what people in my field do is to make recordings in different parts of the brain and try to figure out what this language is. What are those mathematical operations? Both so that we can... I'll say there are two real directions that this research can go. One is, as I just showed you, design of new prosthetics. So people who've lost sensory function or who've lost motor function, we can think about restoring that through the use of appropriate engineering technology. The other side, of course, is pure engineering applications. If we understand how your brain's able to look at your friend and say, I know that face, or you know how your brain is able to drive a car or do various tasks, speech recognition, we can design better artificial algorithms that would do the same thing. So I guess those are. This would be not about replacing function in your own brain, but basically designing artificial intelligences that have some of the same capabilities that you do. Okay, so just to sort of highlight the field, neuroscience is a field that's growing very rapidly, and it has need of a lot of different people with mathematical skills. I wanted to highlight for you some of the areas of math that are most useful in neuroscience, the kind of research that I do. Linear algebra you'll take when you get to college, of course. Probability and statistics, you've probably seen a little bit of that so far. Signal processing, there's the theory of dynamical systems or differential equations that includes things like chaos theory, I'm sure you've heard of. Something called control theory, which would get to the question you asked about how you take sensory inputs and motor inputs at the same time in order to solve a particular task. And then information theory and coding theory is sort of one of the areas that I work on, and I'll tell you a little bit about in detail after the break. So let's should we stop there, and we'll come back in 10 minutes? Great. Can we turn off the monitor, actually? Can we turn the lights back on the board? There we go. Okay, guys, let's get started. We're back from break. Who can tell me where I went wrong? Does two really equal one? Yes?
A minus B equals zero.
Great, great. Good. Yeah, I remember looking at this and walking away with my mind blown and thinking, everything I know is wrong. But luckily, yes, we had it. We said A equals B here. This step is where we went wrong right here. Everything was fine up till here, but we had A plus B times A minus B, B times A minus B. It's like writing, 7 times 0 equals 1 times 0. If you divide by 0, then you get 7 equals 1. Okay? That's where we went awry. So we weren't allowed to cancel this out, cancel these zeros out here to get 2 equals 1. Although I'll tell you one other quick... So this is why you can't divide by 0. Right, you always heard that if you end up with a problem that looks like this, 1 over 0, you can't solve that, right? I'll tell you there actually is a trick for solving this. And it's called rotational math. I don't know if you've seen this before. Rotational math do you know how to solve 1 over infinity? You know what that is? If I divide by an infinitely large number, what do I get? Zero. Right, good. Have you guys seen this before? Okay, this is 1 over infinity equals zero. What I'm going to do is I'm going to rotate by 90 degrees the left-hand side and the right-hand side. Okay, so take this, turn it on its side. What do I get? Negative 18. And I'm going to rotate this 90 degrees as well. That gives me zero. Okay? Now I'm going to add 8 to both sides. So add 8, I get minus 10 equals 8. Right? Now we're going to rotate back 90 degrees. Rotate this way now. This was here, we rotated this way. You get 1 over 0 equals infinity. Okay. So now you know how to solve that problem. Okay, so I want to talk a little bit about, I want to give you some of the basic quantities and concepts that come up in information theory, which is one of the main tools that we use to study the brain. Okay, so I want to think about codes and think about games where you're trying to communicate some information to someone else. Let's start by thinking about where's my most recent notes here. Let's say that I'm thinking of a number between 1 and 8. All right? So I'm thinking of one of these numbers. And your job is to guess which number I'm thinking about, okay? And you can do this only by asking yes or no questions. All right? So you want to think about what kind of question asking strategy you'd like to use. So we can think of one really dumb question-asking strategy right off the bat, right? You could start by asking, well, is the number 1? Yes or no. Is the number 2? Yes or no. Is the number 3? And it would take you... so you could start by asking, is it 1? And you get an answer. Then you could get... If it is 1, you get the answer right away. You're done. If you get no, then you have to ask, well, is it 2? So first of all, how many questions do you need to ask... You need to ask 7, right? Because if you get down to the most number of questions you might need to ask, is it 7? If you get yes, you know that it's 7. If you get no, well, then you know it's 8. Okay, what is the average number of questions? So let's say that I pick, we play this game over and over again, and I pick the numbers 1 through 8 with equal probability. So 1/8 of the time I pick 1, 1/8 of the time I pick 5, etc., at random. What's the average number of questions you have to ask in order to get the answer right? Some people are saying 4. I got a different... So let's see, how do we do this? Well, 1/8 of the time, 1/8 of the time we only have to ask one question, right? 1/8 of the time we ask one question. 1/8 of the time we ask two questions. 1/8 of the time it takes us 3 questions, right? And then all the way down, 1/8 of the time it takes us 7 questions. What are the 8? Okay, so if we add up these numbers, this is 1 plus 2 plus 3 plus 4 plus 5 plus 6 plus 7. So we get 3, 6, 10, 15, 21, 28 divided by 8. 3.5, I think. Okay, so obviously, yeah, if you had to ask all 8 questions, then it would be 4 indeed. But we got a little bit of savings because our seventh question gave us, allowed us to resolve both 7s and 8s. Do you have a question here? Well, I'm kind of just trying to do this intuitively, right? Some of the time, it's 1. If it's 1/8 of the time, it will be 1, and I only had to ask one question. 1/8 of the time, it was a 7, and I had to ask all 7 questions. So I'm applying, I guess, what am I doing? I'm adding up the probability of the number times the number of questions that it took. I was doing 1/8 times 1 plus 1/8 times 2 plus 1/8 times 3. I got something which was 1/8 times, sorry, I should have written this out, 1 plus 2 plus 3 plus 4 plus 5 plus 6 plus 7. Okay, so this sum in here gave me, I had 1/8 of needing only one question, 1/8 probability of needing 2 questions, 1/8 probability of needing 3 questions. Let's move on because do you guys think this is a good question asking strategy?
No.
All right. So this is your first attempt at asking questions. It took you 3.5 questions on average to get the answer right, and I think we can probably do better. So let's think about how we might go about doing better. Think for a second, and I'll ask someone for a suggestion as soon as I get this board erased here. Okay, so if you guys have a better suggestion, who has a better idea of a first question I might ask? Yes? What's that? Okay, so what's the first question? So what's the question you'd ask?
Is it greater than 4.5?
Is it greater than 4, right? So we could ask, is the number greater than 4? Is it greater than 4? Right? And so this would... So this is something called binary search. You've effectively divided the possibilities. If you get a yes, you know that it's either 5, 6, 7, or 8. If you get no, the answer is 1. You know that it's 1, 2, 3, or 4. Okay, so let's say you end up on this branch. You get a no. What's the next question you might want to ask? Yes?
Is it even or odd?
Is it even or odd is one way to ask the question. I'm going to ask for a different way just because I want to make a nice diagram. Here's another question. That's a perfectly valid question. That one is perfectly good. Yes? So you're asking, you can only ask a yes or no question.
So is it greater than 2?
Is it greater than 2? Great. All right, so you could ask, is it greater than 2? If I got a no, it would be 1 or... So the question is it greater than 2? If I get a yes here, I have 3 or 4 remaining. And let's say I get a yes now. What question do you ask now? Is it 3 or is it 4? Either one, you can just ask. Now there's only one question you need, right? If you get a no, you'll say, is it greater than 3? If you get a no, then the answer is 3. If you get a yes, the answer is 4. Did I see a question? Yeah. You could ask, is it a prime number? I would argue that's not going to be a very good question asking strategy, but let's hold off on why. We're going to come back to The big intuition that I want is you want to roughly divide an efficient question asking strategy that I think you guys sort of intuitively picked up on would be one where we can divide. You know, we're uncertain about eight things here, and if we can ask, my first question asking strategy effectively, they didn't ask very informative questions. The first question I asked was, is it one? That effectively divided the possibilities between one on the one hand and seven different numbers on the other. And let's finish this example, and then I'll come back to this. So if I'd gotten here, I want to just complete this tree here. If I'd asked, then is it greater? Each time I'm going to ask, I'm going to divide these in two, and I'll ask, is it greater than or equal to six here? If I get no, I'll have five and six. If I ask yes, I'll know that it's seven or eight. If I have a no, yes, I'll get five. If I get here, I'll get no or yes. Okay, so here's a question now. How many yes or no questions that I need to ask to get the answer right with this question asking strategy?
Three.
Three questions, right? All of them required, right? This is my first question, this layer. I asked, whichever side I got on, I asked a second question here. So this is question one. This is question two here. This bottom layer here, question three. I always got the answer after exactly three questions. Yeah, question? So if I did primes, right, if I could ask other primes, I would say yes if it's 3, 5, or 7, but no if it's 1, 2...
Five.
Sorry, you're right. Duh. Okay. Thank you. That was a test. I knew that. Yeah, okay, so you're right. So primes would be fine for your first question. You're right. You would divide the search space into 2, 3, 5, and 7, so you'd have 4 on the one hand, and then you'd have the other ones. No's would be... Thank you. Would be 1, 2. So yeah, I apologize. You're right. Primes would also work fine. It would be a little bit harder to draw this diagram because we would... Well, here it's a little bit easier to see how we're splitting the search space in two each time. Obviously, your next question would have to be something else. But you're right. You could come up with some other way of defining the ones in one half versus the other.
But I think the binary search thing you made that is more predictable than asking whether it's prime or not.
Is more predictable? What do you mean?
Well, for any number, it could be...
Great.
It's,
you're right. We get, yeah. You're right. If I gave you the numbers 1 through 16, and you wouldn't want to ask your first question is it prime or not, because you'd end up with fewer primes than non-primes in that group there. Okay. So so we've said that the average number of questions you'd need to ask in this case is 3, and in fact it's also exactly the same. That's exactly the number of questions. So there's no variability. The first case I considered, some of the time you got the answer right after one question, some of the times it took 7 questions. On average it took you 3.5 questions. Here you always get it with just with exactly 3 questions. So it's actually, this is a better question asking strategy by on average half a question fewer than you had to ask before. Okay, so let's just make sure our brains are warmed up here. I'm going to ask you, how many questions would you need to ask? How many questions would you need to ask if I gave you a list of the numbers 1 to 32, 1 to 64, 1 to 40, 96? So think about this for a second on your own. Based on whatever strategy, what's the minimum number? Yeah, I would say this is the strategy I would recommend. Binary search. If I gave you the numbers 1 to, actually, why don't we start with 1 to 16? I heard someone say the answer already. Yep. 5, 6, and 12. Okay. I've had someone give us the answer already. Yes. Did you get the same? Does everyone agree that we have? If we added 16 here, so let's say I had 8 things with 3 questions. If I go up to 16 questions, you can imagine, say if I started with 1 to 8 and then 9 to 16, I would need one additional question to get back to only having eight things? Right? My first question could be, is it below eight? And then if it was below eight, I would end up with these eight, and I would need three questions. And if I got it was above eight, I would end up with 9 through 16, and I would need three questions. So I basically, every time... Yes, do you have a question? That's where I'm headed. Yes. So, in other words, each time we double the number of things, we needed one more question to distinguish them. And so the pattern that I want you to, want you to see here is that. Well, do people know logarithms? I thought I'd do a brief tutorial on logarithms. The answer is, if I want to distinguish n things, how many questions do I need to distinguish n things? The answer is log base 2 of n, okay? And I know that some of you may not have seen logarithms before. What is a logarithm? A logarithm is the question, let's say x equals, x is the number of questions to distinguish, yes or no questions to distinguish n things. What I'm asking is, 2 to the x should equal n. All right? So in other words, if n is a power of 2, it's very easy to see how many questions I need to ask. If n is, here we had n was 8, right? For n was 8, we needed to ask 3 questions. When n was 16, we said we needed 4 questions. When n was 32, you know, right? Each time I said to you, each time we double the number of things in our set, we had to ask one additional question. So that's effectively equivalent to raising the power of 2 by 1, 2 to the 5th, and then we ended up with 2 to the 6th was 64. Give us this. And then I gave you how many questions you need to ask to distinguish 4096 things. It turns out that that's 2 to the 12th power. 4096, okay? So each time I double the number of things, I increase the power of 2 by 1. That's equivalent to saying that if I started with this number on the left, I need log base 2 of 4096 is 12, okay? All right. Logarithm is basically, it's the inverse operation of raising something to a power. When I raise it to the power, you guys hopefully know how to do that. The logarithm is saying, what power would I need to, logarithm base 2 would be to say, what power do I need to raise 2 to in order to get that number back? So in other words, if I have 64 things, what power do I need to raise 2 to in order to get 64? Well, I have to raise 2 to the 6th power. Sorry, I have to do 2 to the 64th here. Hopefully no one actually took that seriously. Question back here. So if we had an odd number or some number that was not a power of 2, you can still compute log base 2. And it turns out that that will correspond to the average number of questions you need to ask. But we're going to come to that in a little bit. So just looking ahead, I picked these numbers carefully because they work out well. Okay, let's do a different example now. So we have these... So the take-home from this is if I have n things, how many questions do I need to ask to uniquely identify them? How many yes or no questions? You know, these are binary questions. It's log base 2 of that number of things questions. Do I have a question? Okay. I'm going to give you a new distribution now, and I want you to think of a new question-asking strategy. So I still have the numbers 1 through 8. Sorry, I want to draw this. So I'm still considering numbers drawn from the set 1 through 8, but these numbers don't occur with the same frequencies, with the same probabilities. So when I half the time, I'm telling you that half the time the number I'll be thinking of is 1, okay? And then 1/8 of the time I'll be thinking of 2. 1/8 of the time I'll be thinking of 3. 1/8 of the time I'll be thinking of 4. I'll never think of 5. I'll never think of 6. I'll never think of 7. 1/8 of the time I'll think of 8, okay? So these numbers at the top, I'm going to call this, you know, this is P1 here, this is P2, P3. This is the probability that I think of that number. P3, P4, P5, P6, P7, P8. We should make sure that we've got a good probability distribution here. What do we do to check that? What should be the condition on these numbers, P sub i? They should add to 1, right? We should make sure that the sum of pi up to 8 is equal to 1. That I have a valid probability distribution. Okay, so this is my distribution. Half the time I think of P1 equals 1/2, P2 equals 1/8, etc. This is the frequency with which I think of these things. I want to ask, now let's design a question asking strategy that would be most efficient for figuring out what number I'm thinking of. So what's the first question you might ask? And let's go for simple strategies rather than obscure ones.
Greater than 1.
Okay? Great. So this is indeed correct. What happens if I I'm going to ask the question, is it greater than 1? If I get no, then I know that it's 1. I'm done. Right? I got the answer with one question. If I got that it was, yes, it was greater than 1, well, what possibilities are left?
2, 3, 4.
Good. 2, 3, 4, and 8. What happened to 5? How do I know that it's not 5?
Zero.
So I know that I would never say 5. So you can already rule out 5. Okay. So what's the next question I would ask now?
Odd or even?
I'm going to go for the person who said, "Is it greater than 3?" Just because that makes my diagram nice. So is it greater than 3? Gives me 2 and 3 on this side, and 4 and 8 on this side. And then I'll ask one more question: Is it 2? Or is it greater than 2? Or I'll say, is it 3? Yes or no. I'll ask, is it 8? No gives me 4. Yes gives me 8. Thank you. Okay. Now, how many questions on average do I need to get the answer right here?
3.
On average, you think 3. Okay, who else? Think about it for a second. 3 is not right. Let's work through it. How are we going to solve this? Half the time we needed one question, right? So half the time we had one question. And then the other half of the time, how many questions did we need? Okay, so we have 1/2. 1/2 plus 3/2. So average number of questions and the general formula of this would be the probability that we need to ask that number of questions, right? So the number of questions times the probability that we need that number of questions. We sum those up across all the possibilities. All of these cases over here, 2, 3, 4, 8, we needed 3 questions. Plus, we needed, if you wanted to be precise here, we had zero probability of needing 0 questions, right? We had to ask, if it was really 5 or 6 or 7, we would need to ask 0 questions. That never came up in our tree, but that happened with zero probability, so it doesn't come up. But we end up with 1/2 plus 3/2 equals 2 questions on average. Nice, huh? Okay, so how are we doing on time? Oh. When do you stop? You stop right at noon?
Yeah.
Okay. Great. okay. So what I want to say is we've now gotten to something that has a special name in information theory, which is the entropy. All right. The entropy, this is a concept that was introduced by Shannon in a very famous paper that he wrote in 1948. The entropy, he defined it to be, I'm going to write down the formula for you, is equal to minus the sum of pi log base 2 of pi. All right. Entropy, intuitively, you can think entropy is the average number of questions I need to ask to get the answer right. Okay, so this is let's write it in a slightly different way here. I'm going to write it this way. So it's the probability, so I'll argue this, log base 2 of pi, we should do it this way. This is the simplest way to write it for what we've done so far, is to write it as sum of pi log base 2 of 1 over pi. So if the probability of having an event occur is 1/8, 1 over 1/8 is 8, and I need to ask log base 2 of 8 is what? If I have 8 possibilities, 3 questions. So this is, here I had log of 1 over 1/8, which is 8, times I had a half probability of that happening, and this 1 over pi here, this is 1 over 1/2, this term here is the number of questions. Log base 2 of 1 over the probability is the number of questions I need to ask to get that answer right. And pi here is the probability that I need to ask, the probability that that number of questions is needed. Okay? So 1 over pi, I needed only one question, right? If I divide my probability space in half each time, if something happened with 1/2 probability, I only needed one question to answer it. So log of 1 over 1/2 is log of 2, which is 1. I had one question happened with 1/2 of the time. These other 4 times, 2, 3, 4, and 8, I ended up with 1/8 times, well, I'll let you worry about the details. It's not so critical that you understand this formula. The key that you take away from entropy is it quantifies the average number of yes or no questions you would need to ask in order to get the answer right. And so when I picked these numbers with equal probability, I was equally likely to pick 1, 2, 3, 4, all the way up to 8, you needed to ask 3 questions on average. In this case, when I had a distribution that was not evenly distributed over these numbers, you only needed to ask two questions on average. And we can quantify that average number of questions you need is equal to the entropy. Okay, so you can just take it away. It's the average number of questions I need to ask. It's also the amount by which I can compress. This idea of entropy is very related to the idea of compression. So it's the number of bits I would need to store samples from this distribution versus the number of bits that I would need to store samples from this distribution. So what is a bit? A bit is one. A bit is basically a unit of information, which is what you learn by asking one yes or no question. Okay, so every time I ask one yes or no question, I get back an answer, yes or no. You could think of this as 0 or 1. And so each yes or no question gives me one bit of information. Here I had to ask 3 yes or no questions. That's 3 bits of information. On this other case here, I had to only ask 2 questions on average. So on average, I need 2 bits, 2 yes or no questions. Okay, and what I want to show you is that this kind of tree here, it has a special name. It's called a Huffman tree, and it's actually a way that we can build a binary code for the symbols from this distribution here. Okay, and so what we're going to do now, in the last of the time remaining, I'm going to show you how we can make a code that would need three binary symbols on average to represent these symbols, but it will only need 2 binary symbols on average to represent these numbers here. And then you're going to make a code, and you're going to send a coded message to the person sitting next to you. Okay, so that's the goal here, if we can get through that. I should say, I haven't done this in a group before, so this may fail. Failure is always an option, regardless of what they tell you. Okay, so what is the code? So what do I mean by a code? What I mean is I want to, for each of these numbers, 1, 2, 3, 4, 5, 6, 7, 8. And if you didn't understand the bit about entropy, entropy is just the formal name that we give to this object. Entropy is measured in units of bits, and it's the average number of questions you need, the average number of binary symbols you need to convey. Okay? Looking at this tree here, every time the code for one of these symbols at the bottom here can be represented in binary based on which path through the tree we took. So every time I have a no, that gives me a 0. Every time I have a 1, that gives me a yes. So 0 here. Do we have different colored chalk? We don't. Okay. All right. So if I was asking questions, yes or no, based on this question asking strategy, and I got. I'll do the first one for you. So how do I get to a 1? Well, I would have had to get a no to the first question. The second question, what would I get? No. And then the third question, no. So what's the binary code for 1 is 000, right? All right. What about for 2? Right, I go left 0, and then 1 to the right here, right? So 0, 0, 1. 3 is what?
0, 1, 0.
Right, 0, 1, 0. And I'm going to fill this in for the rest of you. We get a 0, 1, 1, right? 0, 1, 1. Here we go, 1. So what's 5 now? 1, 0, 0. What 6 is 101? You guys call them out, actually. What 7?
110.
110.
111.
And 8 is 111. Great. Okay, so now if I wanted to transmit the message, let's say I want to, I have a number that I want to send through a communication channel, and you could think about this, right? These look a lot like the spike trains that we saw from neurons, right? The brain doesn't send numbers through, it sends spikes. It sends intervals where there is a spike and intervals where there isn't a spike. So although you get some number of photons hitting your retina, ultimately your brain is going to have to take, a very bright, think of this as a very bright light, this is a very dim light. It's going to have to recode these images out in the real world in terms of binary events. And this is not the code that the brain uses, but it's an example of the kind of theory that we use. So if I wanted to to show you that across my retina I had a pattern of 3, 3, 4, 7, I would write down, I would transmit this into a code. 3 gets mapped into 0, 1, 0. I have another 3, 0, 1, 0. And I have 4 maps into 0, 1, 1. 7 maps into 1, 1, 0. So I took this, this code of, actually, let me pick one that will work. Let's pick one that works for later. I'm going to do one. Let's do 1, 3, 2, 1. Okay. So 1 is 000. 3 is 010. I'll make this. Actually, let's make this 8, just for variety's sake. 8 is 111, and then 1 is another 000. So I'm going to transmit this list of binary digits, right? 0000101110000. That comes through my communication channel. That's what my retina sends to my brain. And your brain now has to do decoding. So I send you, ignore this now. Let's say I've forgotten what match. The brain just gets this symbol right here. How do we go about decoding this? Okay, so let's do that. I'm going to go through this, and what's the first thing I do?
So we have to figure out that 3 of the digits, 3 of the characters equals, is going to map to...
Great. So there's an important... So one, you're getting to exactly the point I wanted to make, which is I look at this unbroken string of digits here, zeros and ones, and I might not know if I didn't already know what the code was. In other words, I'm assuming that the downstream, the brain actually knows what this code is. I would have to know where to break the code words. And here, we know that all the code words had length 3. So it's easy to see. So 000 gets mapped to, I looked that up, that's code word 1. 010, why that's a 3. 111, well, that's an 8. And 000, that's a 1. Okay. All right, so you're convinced that we can communicate, we can send arbitrary strings of digits from the numbers 1 through 8, we can map them into binary, and then we can read them out very easily, where each of these symbols requires 3 binary digits. Yes, question. That's the more general algorithm. Yeah, here are all of our code words had length 3, but you've already seen this before, so this will be the second example will be easy for you, but I'll let you do it on your own. Yes, Karen. Oh yeah.
Is this kind of like how telegraph and Morse code works with like
dashes? Similarly related idea. Yeah, you have a set of symbols you want to send, right? How many symbols do you want to send in the alphabet? 26. And you want to map each symbol into a series of dots and dashes. The dots and dashes could be like zeros and ones. So I need a way of representing them. I need a way of mapping the characters 1 through 26, so those numbers, into a series of dots and dashes. You have a code book, and you're going to get out the dots and dashes that come through, and you're going to have to figure out what letters they came back to. So this is exactly like Morse coding. Although here, in a way, we designed the code in a very efficient way that each of these symbols, each of these eight symbols, only requires three binary characters to transmit it. Let's do the same code now. I want to make a code book for this example over here. And we're going to use this same tree, and I'll give you this is called a Huffman tree. And the code we got out here is called a Huffman code. If you haven't, Huffman tree. And this code over here is called a Huffman code. I'll write that up there. Question? Okay. Let's write down the code book over here. And you might be some, I think if you haven't seen this before, hopefully you'll be a little bit surprised that it works. Oops. Okay, so what is our code word, right? So we said no's give you a 1, yes's no's give you a 0, yes's give you a 1. No's give you a 0, yes's give you a 1. Okay, so what is my code word when I want to, so this is my code book over here. Let's write this. What's my code word for 1? Okay, what's my code word for a 2? So you see why it's, right? The code word for 1 is 0. I only needed to have 1 no, I got a 0, and I stopped. How do I code 2?
1,
1, 0, 0, right. How about 3?
1, 0, 0.
1, 0, 1. 4? 1, 1, 0. How about 5? How do I code 5 with this? Great. I never code 5. 5 never gets sent, right? 5 has zero probability of occurring, so I don't need to reserve any space in my code book for it. 5, same thing for 6 and 7. What's the code for 8? Okay. All right. So my code is now, let's try to send the same let's send the same message that we sent over here. The message was 1381. 1381. The code word for 1 is 0. Code word for 3 is what? 101. Code word for 4 for 8 is 111. And the code word for 1 is 0. Okay? So, I sent 4 symbols, right? Half of them were 1s, and I only needed 1, 2, 3, 4, 5, 6, 7, 8. 8 symbols, whereas before I needed 3. I needed 12 symbols here. Okay, so that one I needed to send 3 binary digits, 3 zeros and ones for each one of the code words I wanted to encode. Right, this was 1381. Here, because whenever I sent a 1, I only needed 1 binary digit to send it. Right, whereas these other ones I needed 3. Now, looking at this, you might have thought that this is a confusing problem. Like, how do I? The problem now is to decode. Let's say I don't tell you that it's 1381. How do you go about decoding? So I send you this sequence of binary digits. In fact, let's make up a few more. Okay, how do we decode this? Well, what I'm going to tell you is that we're going to go through. This is the strategy that this gentleman here suggested. You might have thought, well, how do I know where the code words are now, right? Look at this. I'm going to remove these guys. And I added a bunch of zeros and ones out here that I didn't tell you what they were encoding. In fact, I don't even know what they're encoding yet. We're going to have to figure it out. This is a Huffman code is an example of something called a prefix code. Okay? A prefix code has the very nice property that no code word forms a prefix for a different code word. So in other words, 0 is a code word. There is no other code word that has 0 as a prefix. And all these code words start with 1. So I'm never going to get confused. And I'll argue that I'll never get confused. Let's just show ourselves that we never get confused. We can just as the gentleman suggested, we're going to keep going through our symbol string, and when we get enough symbols to have a code word, a valid code word, we'll write down the code word. So we have a 0 here. We know 0 gives us a 1. 1, that doesn't give us a code word yet, right? 1, 0 doesn't give us a code word. We don't have any code words of length 2. By the time we get to 3, we have a code word. 1, 0, 1 is our code word for 3. Right? Then we have 1 is not a code word. 1, 1. 1, 1, 1 is an 8. Then I have a 0. That gives me a 1. Then what's my next? So now I have this. Now you don't know what this code was. Now you guys, actually, why don't you do this yourself? Do this yourself with paper and pencil. Decode this remaining symbol string here. Let me make sure it. Yeah. Sorry. I don't know if you, let me make sure you can read this. I'll just rewrite this here. Okay, so you're gonna do the same thing we did. Go through these remaining digits, right? 1100101100. And when you get a code word, write down the associated readout letter. Yes. You ready? Okay. What's the next symbol that I should pull out?
4,
right? 110 was 4. What's this one here? 0 is a code word. I get a 1. 101 is a 3. And then 100 is a 2. Okay. So even though I have code words of different length, I never get confused when reading them out. Because I would have a problem if let's say I decided to code 5 by 01. That wouldn't work, right? 01 has the prefix 0. Which is this code here. Okay, we only have 3 minutes left, so I want to give you a problem that you can work on either now or you can take it home with you. Actually, I'll give you 2 examples, and you guys write down the... Okay, so here's your task. I'm going to give you 2 probability distributions over the numbers 1 through 8. And what I want you to do is to make the Huffman tree and make the Huffman code for each one. Okay? So these are my numbers, 1 through 8. And the first one I'm going to give you are 2 different probability distributions. The first one looks like this. 1 16th, 1 16th, 1 16th, 1 16th. This is... and then so the first 4 digits all have a probability of 1 16th of occurring. Then I have 1 8th, 1 8th, 1 4th. 1/4. Okay, so this is probability distribution 1. Then I'm going to give you a second one, which is probability distribution P2, which has this. It's 1/64. So this is the, I should say, what are these numbers? This is the probability that this symbol occurs in the input. Okay, so the symbol 1. I'll delete these guys at the top here. That was our first example. This is P1, P2, P3, P4 would be these numbers. 1 occurs with probability 1 16th. 2 occurs with probability 1 16th. 3 occurs with 1 16th, etc. In this distribution here, the other example will be this one, 1 64th, 1 64th, 1 32nd, 1 16th, 1 8th, 1/4. Oops, I ran out. What did I do wrong? 1/30. Okay. Here's code book 1. So here are your questions. I'll write the questions for you. So what is the tree that you? What is the Huffman tree? What is a Huffman tree? Would be another way of saying it. For each code. So in other words, write the tree just as we did here. Where would you point? What would your first question be? How would you design an optimal tree that allows you to ask questions, requiring the fewest number of questions on average? Two is, what is the entropy? Of P1 and P2. In other words, how many bits would I need to use on average to either encode these digits from this distribution or digits from this distribution? So in other words, which one, if I told you, you're going to have to transmit bits from one of these distributions, which one would require fewer average symbols, fewer average bits? And third is, I was going to have you do this, but we're out of time. I'll say, encode a 6-digit message. Encode a 6-digit digit message, send it to you, the person sitting next to you, and have them decode it. Okay, you're not going to have time to do that here, but if you have a friend, or you can go home and explain this to your parents or your friends, you can then take some six-digit number that consists of the digits 1, 2, 3, 4, 5, 6, 7, 8, 7 and 8, and then code it using the resulting coding tree that you get, and then have your friend decode it. Just to give you a heads up, the rough question asks, you're going to want to do the same thing that we did before. You're going to want to ask questions in a way that allows you to divide the available probability mass in two with each question. So you want each question to provide roughly the same amount of information. And you should be able to use the Huffman tree to count how many questions you need to ask to uniquely identify which number it is. And then the number of times that occurs, how often that occurs, is the probability that you need to ask that number of questions. That will give you the entropy. And then you can make the Huffman code just as we did here. Every time you get a no, that gives you a 0. Every time you get a yes, that gives you a 1. Okay, so thank you very much for coming.